We'll call a meeting of the Energy Finance and Policy Division to order. Members, I had asked Deputy Commissioner Murphy at the end of last session when we were running out of time if he would be kind enough to come back today to field any questions that we might have. Other members may have questions. I had a couple in particular that I did want to pursue. One issue that in fact has come up just since our last meeting that I became aware of in meeting with the members of some of our regional credit unions yesterday, in which we were told that basically at this point, because of and it's not exactly clear, because of some decisions on the part of, I don't know whom, I hope you do, Commissioner Murphy, it's virtually impossible to get a loan for a manufactured home in the state. Do you know anything about that?
Mr. Chairman, I've not heard that.
The people that were telling us about that yesterday from the credit unions thought that that was a decision that had been basically made by Fannie Mae. But if you don't know anything about that, I would appreciate it if you would pursue that, because that I think has some pretty serious implications for a lot of people, particularly in more rural parts of the state.
I want to make sure I understand, Mr. Chairman. So the credit unions are saying that Fannie Mae is no longer making mobile home loans?
Right.
I will look into that, Mr. Chairman. It's the first I've heard of that.
There's no secondary market for those loans. Commissioner Murphy, the question that I had hoped to be able to ask at the end of the meeting on Monday was about examinations. And when you do the examinations, what depth do you go into in portfolios, loan portfolios? The thing I'm wondering is, I realize that our state banks are probably not as deeply involved in some of the subprime and other questionable loan practices that we've seen on a national level, but this seems to have come as a surprise to a lot of people in the industry, and I'm just wondering, if your examination practice did not reveal any of these weaknesses, you know, at least a couple, 3 years ago, why not? Or if it did, why didn't we hear anything about it?
Mr. Chairman, very broad question. Our examinations of banks and credit unions are fairly intense. Especially in the looking over the loan portfolio of an institution. Our examiners probably look at half of the dollar volume of loans in a typical bank. But the good loans are the ones that get paid back, and the bad loans are the ones that don't, and it's often difficult at the onset to tell which are which. Of course, when we have an economic downturn, a lot of the bad loans come to the surface because the borrowers are either unable or unwilling to repay the loans. One area where we see a fair amount of trouble in the current environment is residential housing development lending, where a bank or a financial institution would make loans to a contractor to build a bunch of new houses. And of course, the housing market has kind of fallen apart for a variety of reasons, but there are a number of banks with loans on their books secured by building lots, where the likelihood of a house being built on that lot anytime soon is very remote, so the value of those building lots have plummeted. Of course, not very many people saw the downturn coming, particularly with the severity and the depth that it's reached. So there's a little bit of fortune telling that goes on in examining financial institutions. I think it was Yogi Berra that said it's difficult making predictions, especially about the future.
Yes, I think we're all discovering that. Well, Commissioner, then the question would be, in light of hopefully some lessons learned in the recent past, are practices changing? Are you looking at different things in examinations?
Mr. Chairman, yes. Actually, I think in one of the problems is that there's been way too much borrowing in this country at all levels, in the government, in the banking system, and at the retail level. And I think some people have been living beyond their means, and that's caught up with a lot of people. So there's some painful adjustments going on, but I think people are scaling back their borrowing-oriented lifestyle.
Representative Hoppe?
I'll pass, Mr. Chair.
Well, Commissioner Murphy, I recognize that, but the question really was, are you doing anything differently in your examinations of financial institutions and other entities that you examine?
Mr. Chairman, we're doing similar things from to what we've always done. We've changed our focus to concentrate more on the institutions that are having troubles, which are increasing in number. And I guess one other area that we're paying a lot more attention to is bank liquidity. In the situation of a failing bank, the classic way that a bank would fail would be it would have enough loan losses so it's exhausted their net worth, and we would revoke their charter and arrange a merger with a more healthy bank. In the last 8 or 10 years, a lot of banks have, in addition to taking depositor funds, they've borrowed money from the Federal Home Loan Bank, a federal entity which makes loans to banks to make more real estate loans. So I think 25% of state bank assets in Minnesota are now funded by borrowed funds. And of course, when a bank hits a rough patch and starts having losses, then the lender is not often interested in continuing to loan money to that bank. So if a bank has loan problems, they'll have the double whammy of loan losses, and then on the other hand, the lender that's loaned them funds is not willing to continue to loan money, so then they have a liquidity squeeze. And the classic failure where the net worth is exhausted is that can be timed and managed, but if a bank literally runs out of cash, that failure can come up very, very quickly. We're paying a lot more attention to the liquidity issues than we had previously. And the Federal Home Loan Bank seems to have gotten religion last August and changed the deal and become much more stringent very abruptly, in our opinion.
Now, was there other further questions for Commissioner Murphy? Representative Kaling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And not a question, just a compliment to Commissioner Murphy that I had asked about the payday lending regulations. I haven't had a chance to fully absorb the response that you gave me, but did respond immediately the next day, and I just want to thank you for that and look forward to working more on making sure we protect consumers from predatory lending through that avenue. Thanks.
Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair. And Commissioner Murphy, we've met with you before about the health care insurance issue, and considering the increasing cost of health care and the part that plays in our state budget, I'm wondering if there's any more thought about initially when we had the HMOs look at our public plans or manage our public plans, the idea was that they would save us money, and I'm not sure that that has ever been addressed or proven or looked at, and I'm wondering if there's any more thought about looking into that.
Mr. Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think I'm a little bit out of my league in that question, and I don't think I have the level of expertise for a meaningful response.
Well, Commissioner Wilson, I guess probably someone in the department does. If you could kind of get back to Representative Bly, we'd appreciate that.
Are there further questions at this time?
Seeing none, thank you. Deputy Commissioner Murphy, we appreciate your coming back and indulging us.
My pleasure, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you. So, members, our intention then is just to take up where we left off. And Monday's agenda, and that would be at this time with Diane Wells from the Telecom Division. While we're getting set up here, I would point out, members, that there are two sets of minutes in your packets, one with a demonstration set and the other is in the more normal form. Representative Falk, if you would care to move the more normal form of the minutes from January 26th, I would appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move approval of the January 26th minutes in the normal or ordinary form.
Thank you. Are there any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of their approval, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. And members, if you don't want to start seeing minutes in the other form, I would really appreciate it if you would try to get here on time and stick around to hear what these people have taken the trouble to come and talk with us have to say. Representative,
Chair, just remembering that a former chair who is no longer in this body, but Representative Maris used to give Mars bars this treat. And I noticed I was in here at 2:45 on the dot at the last meeting. I just throw that out for consideration.
Thank you, Representative Norris. I appreciate that.
It must be healthy
bars.
Well,
of course, you know, there's a... I don't know of any healthy bars. Of course, there's the healthy fasteners. Maybe we could get those people in. Apply them where they would be useful.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Weston.
I think you read between the lines, but I think Representative Morris must be saying there's either a carrot or a stick approach, and a Mars bar might be similar to a carrot.
Yes, I appreciate that, Representative Weston.
Out of the committee budget, of course.
I think that... The committee budget is basically in the same shape as the rest of the state budget currently, Representative Western. Ms. Wells, welcome to the committee. Commissioner Wilson.
Thank you, Chairman Hilde, and members of the committee. And once again, I just want to thank you very much for the opportunity to present more in detail than we're usually given. So it's very much appreciated by the department. And I'd like to introduce Ms. Wells by just mentioning that she does have 23 years with the state, 17 at the PUC and telecom, and the last six with our department, and has done an outstanding job and has great background in education for her job.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Hilde, and members of the committee, for the opportunity to provide comments today. As Commissioner Wilson indicated, my name is Diane Wells, and I'm here to provide some background information on what the Telecommunications Division does within the Department of Commerce. first of all, I'd like to talk about the regulatory structure in Minnesota a little bit, because we're quite different from most other states. In the vast majority of other states, the advisory and advocacy staff are all within what's called the Public Utilities Commission or the Public Service Commission. And back in 1980, the legislature decided that the advocacy and the advisory staff should be separated in Minnesota. And the advisory staff went with what became the Public Utilities Commission, and the advocacy staff moved to what was the Department of Public Service. And what that means is that when the Public Utilities Commission has a case pending in front of it and it wants to go to its staff to discuss the matter, the commissioners don't have to worry that the person they're talking to may have been an advocate for a particular outcome in a similar proceeding. And what other states do is create what's kind of a wall between their advisory and advocacy staff, and we don't have to do that here because we're in two separate agencies. So what we have at the Department of Commerce is the advocacy staff, and we're treated like a party in proceedings before the commission. That means we can't have ex parte communications with the commissioners. So it's totally separate, the advisory and the advocacy staff. And the Department of Commerce staff is also the investigative and enforcement arm of the commission to make sure that the commission orders, rules, and state law are carried out. Now, with that in mind, I'd like to turn to the telecommunications industry in Minnesota. We have in the state 96 incumbent telephone companies, including Quest, which is the largest, and then mid-sized companies like Embark and Frontier. And then we have small companies ranging in size from Hickory Tech, which serves Mankato, down to Northern Telephone Company, which serves the Wawena area and has less than 50 access lines. We also have approximately 340 companies that are authorized to provide long-distance service in the state, and we have about 175 what we call CLECs, or competitive local exchange carriers, and they offer local telephone service in competition with the incumbent providers. Many of the CLECs also provide long-distance service, so of the 340, some of those include the 175 CLECs. Now, some of these competitive local companies continue to rely on the incumbent providers for that last mile connection to the home and business, either through resale or leasing of the incumbent network, or other competitors have completely overbuilt that last mile. And one example of a company or a competitor with its own facilities to the home would be Comcast, which also provides phone service in Minnesota. Now, prior to 1984, the incumbent local telephone companies provided all of the local service in Minnesota, and AT&T provided all of the long-distance service. In 1984, AT&T was divested, and long-distance competition started to take off, with companies like MCI and Sprint entering the market. In 1996, at the federal level, the Telecommunications Act was passed, which provided structure to and stimulated the growth of competition for local telephone service. Now, this very brief history of the telecommunications industry guides the regulatory framework in Minnesota. We have many laws that go back to the turn of the century that still address how companies have to provide local and long-distance service. For example, that companies must interconnect their networks and that they can't discriminate. We've had more recent laws added that some of you that have been around may recall working on that cover how competitive providers are regulated and how lesser regulation applies to incumbent telephone companies. That update the state's goals with regard to telecommunications services, and that incorporate consumer protections, such as an annual notice of all service options must be provided to customers, credit for incorrect directory assistance, customer authorization required to change a local or long-distance provider on for a customer, and the types of third-party charges allowed on a phone bill. In addition to the growth of competition, there have been many, many changes in technology in the field of telecommunications. Today, so some customers no longer receive service from a landline company, but have cut the cord and do all of their voice communications with a cell phone. Wireless providers receive their licenses from the FCC, and by law, their rates are overseen by the FCC. Consumer protection issues, aside from rate charges, are largely addressed in the contract that customers have with their wireless providers. And when we get complaints, with wireless, we refer those to the Attorney General's office, which has some contract ability to work to resolve those issues. A second area of advancement has been in the growth of broadband service, generally provided by a telephone company as digital subscriber line or DSL service, or in some cases we have fiber all the way to the home in Minnesota. Or broadband can be provided by a cable company through a cable modem. Broadband service has been classified as an information service by the FCC, so broadband rate, speed, and availability are not regulated at the state level. A broadband connection is necessary for the most recent method to communicate by voice, and that is voice over internet protocol, or VoIP, provided by companies like Vonage. In Minnesota, we have a court ruling that nomadic voice service is not a regulated telephone service, and nomadic voice is where you can take your VoIP phone with you when you travel. So if you have like a 612 phone number and you take everything with you, if you're in a hotel in New York, people dial your 612 number and they reach you there. The regulation of fixed VoIP service, which is what more of the cable companies are offering, is still in dispute, and we are awaiting decisions by the FCC. This is an important matter as we're seeing more and more calling moving to the VoIP technology. In terms of broadband services, I should also mention that broadband can be provided through satellite offerings like that offered by WildBlue, DirecTV, and EchoStar, and we also have Wi-Fi offerings being made available by small private niche providers and municipalities, and then there's also wireless broadband provided by the cell phone companies. Now, with all of these service types and technologies available, and with state regulatory authority limited to landline telephone services, you're probably wondering what the Department of Commerce's responsibilities are in the area of telecommunications regulation. Briefly, all of the regulated companies are required to keep their current rates on file, and the department processes approximately 1,500 dockets a year addressing rates or conditions of service. The Telecommunications Act of 1996 also gave responsibility for overseeing the interconnection agreements between companies to the state, so the department is involved in reviewing those agreements and the amendments, and in instances where the interconnecting companies cannot agree on terms, we serve as a party to these disputed matters, which are generally heard by an administrative law judge with a final decision made by the Public Utilities Commission. And for example, last week we had two of our staff members testify in a contested case between Quest and Charter. Also, all new entrants must receive certification before entering the market. The department reviews all of these applications to determine whether the company has the financial, managerial, and technical ability to provide service. These companies must all have 911 plans, tariffs, and interconnection agreements filed and approved before they can start operating. Additionally, all mergers and acquisition where the ownership of the regulated company changes must be reviewed and referred to the PUC for a decision. For example, we just recently filed comments with the Public Utilities Commission on the Century-Cal and BART merger. Carriers wishing to obtain public subsidies from the Federal Universal Service Fund must be certified annually at the state level, and the department performs that investigation and makes a recommendation to the Public Utilities Commission. Consumer complaints regarding phone service go to the Consumer Affairs Office at the Public Utilities Commission for mediation, but if there are complaints that are indicative of a systemic problem with a provider or a service, the department conducts the investigation. And finally, we have many miscellaneous filings that we investigate and make recommendations to the Public Utilities Commission on, such as filings regarding promotions, rate changes, directory assistance, numbering issues, boundary changes, etc. So those are the department's core regulatory responsibilities. However, legislation passed last session also brought the department more actively into the area of broadband, though not in a regulatory role. First, Commissioner Wilson serves on the Ultra High Speed Broadband Task Force, and the department also provides staff to that task force. And the task force is made up of a cross-section of about 23 broadband providers and users. It has been meeting since July and will be submitting a report by November 1st addressing issues such as a recommended connection speed that is reasonably needed by all citizens by 2015, a description of policies and actions necessary to achieve that goal, how the public and private sectors can cooperate, the costs to reach that goal, and an evaluation of how broadband can benefit education, healthcare, community-based organizations, and government. Also, due to legislation passed last session, the department is involved with a broadband mapping project for Minnesota. The department contracted with a nonprofit called Connected Nation to map broadband availability in Minnesota, and that project will tell us where geographically we have no broadband available, where there is one provider, or where there are multiple providers. And the information will also tell us the speed of the broadband at a county level. So the preliminary map should be available next week, and Connected Nation will be here to present to the House Telecommunications Regulation and Infrastructure Division, chaired by Representative Johnson, next Friday, February 6th. Connected Nation also has a website for Minnesota at www.connectmn.org, where residents currently can go and test their broadband feed from their home computers or work. And they can also fill out a form and submit that electronically if they don't think broadband is available. Once the broadband maps are complete, residents will also be able to type in their address and be hot linked to providers that should be serving that address. The broadband maps should also help us identify areas where projects can be found to possibly qualify for the federal economic stimulus plan being debated in the U.S. House and Senate, probably as we speak. And under the House and Senate version, there's an allocation between $6 and $9 billion for broadband to unserved or underserved areas. And I just want to quickly go to some slides. This is the Telecommunications Division budget for the upcoming biennium. And this is the expenditures for the past years of biennium. And then we also have the Telecommunications Access Minnesota program within the division, and that's the relay program that provides telecommunications access for Minnesotans with hearing, sight, speech, and physical limitations. And that program is actually funded by a 6 cent per month surcharge on all telephone lines, wireline and wireless. And the funding for CAM is allocated to direct transfers for rural captioning to DHS for accessible news to DEED and to the Minnesota Commission for Deaf and Hard of Hearing. And then within the CAM program, we have the administration, the relay service, and equipment distribution. And just as an example of what that program does, in 2007, the relay averaged 76,705 calls per month in Minnesota and also provided equipment to 1,771 new participants and 924 repeat participants. And then the program also does repair work on equipment that's already out there. Those are the comments that I have, and I'd be happy to try and answer any questions you have.
Are there questions from members at this time? Seeing none, thank you. As well as we do have an aggressive agenda, so.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, we have one last element of the commerce area of the department, and that is in the administrative services and some of the particular areas of function. And Mr. Pearson, who's been with the department for 12 years, 8 of those years he headed up the Petro Fund, is an outstanding manager, so we asked him to take over a difficult area of licensing. He did that for 2 years, and the last 2 years he served as my assistant. And Mr. Pearson can cover these specialty areas.
Mr. Pearson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Jim Pearson, and I'm an assistant commissioner in the administrative services area of the Department of Commerce. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you a little bit this afternoon. Administrative services is not always seen as the most exciting part of the department, so I don't always get such an audience, but certainly appreciate the opportunity to share a little bit about what we do and who we are. As you can see from the slide behind me, our area includes the Commissioner's Office, Human Resources, Information Technology, and our central management and support functions. It's also our goal to make sure that the department our operations are managed in accordance with law and certainly within the goals of the administration. I also wanted to talk a little bit about the three programs at the Commerce Department that fit into the administrative services area and that we have authority over. They are the Petro Fund program, unclaimed property, which we talked briefly about on Monday, as well as our Ways and Measures Division. Before I jump on to the three programs, I did want to give the committee a brief overview of our expenditures and the number of folks working in this area of our department. As you can see, our base budget is roughly $5.7 million. With the governor's release of his budget yesterday, that number is going to be trimmed a bit, but we're in the process of looking at how to do that. We also have approximately 46 FTEs dedicated to this area of our department, and you can see the breakdown there. Included in that last item of all other are folks like myself our communications people, legislative affairs, our mailroom front desk, and some others. So that'll give you a sense on who's encompassed in that 17.2 number. So with that brief introductory overview of our area, the PEPFAR Fund is the first program that I wanted to address. Our director, executive director of that program is Joel Fisher. Joel's worked in that program since 1994 and has been guiding it over the last 2 years, and we're very pleased to have somebody that capable running the day-to-day operations. Just a few words on its origin. The program was created in 1987 as part of a growing problem at that time with underground storage tanks. A lot of reports of contaminated groundwater and people drinking that water, using that water. So that combined with the fact that commercial insurance was becoming very difficult to find for most tank owners, the majority of states, Minnesota included, created a state fund, gave it the PEPFAR Fund label, and it really responded to this federal legislation that was passed that required tank owners to have financial assurance in order to clean up petroleum leaks from tanks that they owned. The program does that by reimbursing eligible applicants for a portion of their eligible cleanup costs, and that's how that program is works to help tank owners in our state meet that federal requirement. Just a quick overview of our expenditures in that program. As Commissioner Wilson has already set the tone in our earlier comments, we pride ourselves at the department of working efficiently and streamlining whatever programs we can, and certainly the PEPFAR Fund is no exception. As you can see, 93% of our money goes to the claims and roughly 7% goes to the administration of the program. The funding mechanism in that program is unique in that it's a 2 cents per gallon fee that's placed on the first licensed distributor in the state. That is interesting in that it blinks on and off depending on the balance, so it's not a continuous fee. Historically, that fee is on about 4 of the 12 calendar months. When the fee is on for that 4-month block, it generates about $25 million worth of revenue, and that revenue is used by the program to pay the claims. We are statutory obligated to provide a deed with the money to run a volunteer program. It's a grant program that's administered from that office or that agency. We also provide money for fund finance work, and we can talk more about that if the committee desires. But those three large expenditures add up to that approximate $25 million number. And we have 8 FTEs assigned to the program, which are there to assist Joel in managing the claims and making sure those are done in an efficient manner. Another piece of the PEPFAR Fund is its governing board. This is a 5-member board that's appointed by the governor. They oversee the program and also are involved in any disputes and dispute resolution. They meet approximately 6 times per year. And they meet here with the department staff and provide, I think, a nice avenue for constituents who feel that whatever reimbursement recommendation the department's made, if that's not to their liking, they have a good vehicle to have their case heard. Just wanted to give the committee a sense of the annual reimbursements that the program has had over the last 4 years. You can see we averaged about 1,100 applications over that time frame and reimbursing about $10 million in claims direct to tank owners. And I just put a footnote at the bottom there. Last fiscal year, the Pollution Control Agency received 384 new petroleum releases. So you can see that there is still ongoing activity and need for the program. We're proud of the fact that this program is a mature program, and we're certainly not at the numbers we were in the early 90s when anywhere from 1,100 to I think the peak was almost 1,500 releases reported in a year. So you can see we've done, in combination with the MPCA, a lot of great work, but there's still a certain amount of work that is ongoing. So I'd like to switch gears then and leave the PEPFAR Fund and touch briefly on unclaimed property. Unclaimed property is managed by Amy Trumper in our division. Amy has over 10 years experience working for the state and joined our department just a little over a year ago, and we're very pleased to have her managing the day-to-day operations in this area. Again, very briefly to the program's origin, created in 1969 under the Uniform Disposition of Unclaimed Property Act, and that is the law that requires insurance companies or banks, government agencies, and so forth to turn over abandoned property. It is funded, as I mentioned, out of the administration or administrative division. And of that 5.7 I mentioned, as far as the base budget number, approximately $500,000 is used to administer the unclaimed property area. And that program has approximately 7 FTEs. In last fiscal year 08, the unit had over 31,000 claims, inquiries, and web contacts. Among that number, among that 31,000, is approximately 10,000 telephone calls the department received. And Amy and her group really do place a priority on getting to those calls, making sure that when somebody calls the department that they get somebody who is knowledgeable in the area and can help them. So that's an area that certainly is prioritized, as well as our web presence. Another area that, or another priority in that program is increased holder compliance. We try to do more and more work in making sure that those companies that are required to turn over abandoned property actually do that. That work involves cross-referencing lists and various other activities to make sure that holders are turning over the abandoned property. As Commissioner Wilson has repeatedly talked about, this is streamlining efforts, engaging technology, utilizing technology is very important to us, and unclaimed property has also been a beneficiary of a new system called Wagers, which has helped us streamline and respond to people faster, so we're pleased about progress that tool has allowed us to really make some good progress. And again, just to give you some context there, last year the staff returned over $18 million of unclaimed property to their rightful owners, so that's something, again, that the department places a high emphasis on. This chart gives you a sense of about the amount of properties that the state takes in and the amount of property that we're able to return to the rightful owners over the last 5 years. You can see 2006 was a bit of an interesting year, and Tim mentioned in his comments on Monday about that and the denutralization process that occurred that year, which caused that spike. So again, that will give you a basic understanding of the unclaimed property area. Again, our primary performance measurement tool is making sure that those claims are processed in a very timely manner. Certainly, our written materials talk about 90 days. We are well under that, and very proud of the fact that we can get unclaimed property back to the rightful owners in a efficient manner. The last program I wanted to touch on is our weights and measures area, which is a fun area as you get more and more involved in what Commerce Department does. This is an area that comes up frequently, so I wanted to spend just a few minutes on it. It's unique in that it is not located here in St. Paul. It's down in Burnsville in a new facility that we're quite proud of. Moved down there a couple years ago. Simply said, the weights and measures division is responsible for maintaining standards of measurement of mass, volume, length, and density. Also has the responsibility to ensure the quality of petroleum products. We do that through testing throughout the distribution chain, so that's another key competence of the area. And another fun fact about weights and measures, of course, is one of the oldest continuously operating areas of Minnesota state government. Commenced operations back in 1885, so it has a nice history, and of course our Burnsville facility has a few pictures of operations back then that are always interesting to look at. Just a word about funding. The Weights and Measures Division is funded through the petroleum inspection fee that's assessed at $1 per 1,000 gallons. Again, similar to the Petro Fund, it's assessed on the licensed distributor in the state. The Weights and Measures Division gets 81 cents of that dollar. The remaining 19 cents goes to the general fund and stays there. We have annual expenditures with our staff there of approximately $3.2 million, and we have 31.5 FTEs devoted to the Weights and Measures area. There are seven pieces here that I just want to quickly highlight, the first one being our metrology lab. The metrology lab is, I think, one of the showcases of our Burnsville facility. It's, as Commissioner Wilson has often commented, is a state-of-the-art facility and very important to commerce in our state. Its customers include companies like Medtronic, 3M. The services that it provides, the calibration services it provides to those companies and calibrating their test kits and other things are vital to their business. So that's a very important piece. The petroleum lab is also...
Excuse me just a minute. Representative Atkins, very well. We'll come back to Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
As soon as you're finished, Mr. Pearson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
The petroleum lab is also something that is very important to Minnesota and not only for fuel quality, but for fuel standards. It also is involved in verifying octane, and we get into, obviously, the ethanol content requirements, biodiesel content. The lab is often involved in ensuring that those standards or those mandates are present. Package checking would be a third area. This is ensuring that customers, when they go to the grocery store and buy a pound of ground beef, that package that was put together at the deli actually holds a pound. Very important consumer protection type work that is done. Field device inspection is a fourth prong there, and that is something that I think is also important in consumer protection. These are our staff that are out in the field checking the accuracy of gas pumps and grocery store deli scales and whatnot. Certainly, if you have an 18-gallon gas tank in your automobile and you put 20 gallons in according to the pump, that raises concerns. So the accuracy of those pumps from a consumer protection standpoint is critical. Placing in service companies, the department oversees about 180 companies and 540 permit holders. An example of this would be... I guess last summer I went to do some landscaping and pulled in a garden facility down in Invergrove Heights and large scale, and I pulled my Jeep up under that, and they weighed me, and off I went to the yard and came back. They weighed me again. Those type of scales are put in by private companies, and the waste and measures area needs to be there at the time of installation to ensure that it's done. Also needs to be monitoring those companies to make sure that when they're doing work, whether it's new installation or repair work, that that's done in accordance with state law. And again, it's a consumer protection activity that we do. Complaints and investigations, the sixth piece that I wanted to highlight for the committee. Again, alluded to some of this, complaints such as that I bought more gas than my car will hold. How can that be? We get many, many complaints about the low-cost gas selling. That's another area that the department and Waste and Measures deals with. We get complaints from other states that a particular grocer or manufacturer is packaging a product that's 16 ounces net weight and it's not 16 ounces. So we'll go in and look at some of those things as well. And that leads me to the last piece, audits. We follow up on random things such as tips from other states or consumer complaints and do surprise audits at different facilities, as well as making sure that we have an audit trail for scales. So if a repair has been made, that we have a record of that and can track that process. That is also very important to overseeing that part of our business. The other thing about Waste and Measures that I wanted to make sure the committee understood is it also has a revenue generating capacity. We generate about $1.4 million annually. I mentioned our expenditures about $3.2 million coming from petroleum inspection fees. This money that's generated here goes right to the general fund. And I mentioned that our metrology lab, for example, when they provide services to Medtronic or 3M, they charge for those services, and that's how some of these fees are generated. The point of this slide is really to show that 75 to 80% of the revenue we generate comes from two areas, and that is our heavy-duty scales and our metrology lab. Again, wanting to touch on performance measures and how we evaluate Waste and Measures, accreditation is a huge piece of how we see ourselves and what kind of job we see ourselves doing. The metrology lab is very highly regarded, and it is also accredited by the National Voluntary Laboratory Accreditation Program. And Minnesota is the only state, or of the states that touch our border, we are the only state who has that accreditation. So we have companies from outstate coming to our Burnsville facility because in the private sector that's a very meaningful accreditation, and they need to make sure that their calibration services are done by a facility that has that type of quality control. So again, when you achieve that, that is something that we're very proud of, and that speaks to the staff down in Burnsville and the job that they do. The last point I wanted to make, again, is about the work we do and how we evaluate it. Looking at our field folks, this is very important that we have a regular field presence. Regular and frequent field inspections are critical to our mission. We are proud of the fact that gas pumps have an accuracy rate of approximately 96%. Grocery store scales have an accuracy reading of approximately 90%. And we feel that because we have that field presence and because we are out there doing the work to protect consumers, that there's a confidence there that's instilled in us. And when we see that the merchants are really working hard to make sure that they maintain their equipment and calibrated correctly, that's good for commerce throughout the state. So that's another thing that we put quite a high regard on in evaluating our program mission down in Burnsville. So with those comments, I would be happy to address any questions or certainly give way to the folks at the Office of Energy Security for their comments, too.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. Representative Atkins.
Well, Mr. Chair, I've had the privilege of serving as the chief author of the Weights and Measures Bill, and I think I can limit my questions to 30 to 40 minutes at most. So I have a question that just got a freak out when somebody says that, though, doesn't it, Mr. Pearson? I had two questions. One on the Petro Fund, that's been around for a long time. Is there a trend? Are we starting to see a decline in the number of claims to the Petro Fund, or is it plateauing? And then my second question, maybe I don't know if you'll have the answer, but remember that in the old days, I think the unused gift certificates, gift cards used to cheat to the state as unclaimed property. I don't believe that they do that anymore, but if you have a sense of what kind of money that would represent, if you do, if you don't, maybe you can see if there's some accurate source that I could go to find that. So Petro Fund trend, and then the cheating of the gift cards, or what we're talking about in terms of the amount.
Mr. Pearson. Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, I can speak to one of the two items, batting 500. The Petro Fund program definitely is trending down. Our heyday was in the early 90s. As I mentioned, I think the 1990 was the high year as far as releases reported, and that was just under 1,500 releases reported. Back in 92 and 93, we were reimbursing approximately $32 to $33 million annually in claims. So when we look at the last 5 years and see an average of about $10 million, we certainly are on the downswing of that trend. I think the real question is, at what point will that level off? I mean, ideally, we would like to have zero releases reported on an annual basis. I'm not sure we'll reach that goal, but there is certainly a lot of work being done on that, and we can certainly talk in more detail on that, too, as far as owner-operator training and new requirements that are coming in and what effect they may be having. Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins, to your second question, I will have to follow up. We can certainly talk with Amy. Amy is here today. We could maybe speak after the meeting, or Mr. Chair, however you'd like to handle that question, but we'd certainly find that answer and make sure that you're properly informed.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't expect you to have the answer offhand. The fact that I asked the question, and the fact that we have a $5 billion deficit at the states, and that's something we used to collect, and I suspect, Mr. Chair, that I may get a bombardment of retailers that will look me up now and ask me what my intentions are, but it would be interesting to at least get our arms around how big of a number that is. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Pearson.
Representative Atkins, I've observed you have a tendency to attract bombardments. I don't know what it is.
I feel most at home when people are bombarding me, so thank you.
Are there further questions for Mr. Pearson at this time? Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Pearson, actually, I have two unrelated questions. The first is I would just like to have you talk a little bit about the complaints on the below-cost gas. What enforcement actions do you do? I've had a few problems with this from some folks in the past. And I would like to know that. And then a little bit more on the metrology lab. Did you say it was the only accredited one in the state or in the nation? I'm sorry, I missed that. And how many out-of-state companies do come to you for testing? Thank you.
Mr. Pearson. Mr. Chair, Representative Saylor, I will do my best with those questions. I also realizing in my trying to cover this material, I rudely did not mention Mark Vicelli as our director of our waste and measures area. I mentioned the other two individuals and forgot Mark. I must apologize for that. But Mark is here today and I think can better address those two questions. I guess that's probably the best way to handle it in the interest of time is to follow up. We can either bring Mark down and have him address it, or we can take the questions after the committee, whatever your wish is, Mr. Chair.
Representative Taylor, if you'd be willing to pursue that after committee, I think we should try to stick to our agenda. Representative Stuart Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Pearson, I'm assuming that at some point in time, that unclaimed property is forfeited to the state, and I'm wondering what that time period is.
Mr. Pearson. Mr. Chair, Representative Jackson, 3 years is the timeline that abandoned property must be turned over to the state.
Thank you. That's the time limit for them to hold it before they turn it over to the state. How long does the state hold it before it's not held anymore and it forfeits to the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jackson, that depends. Stocks and things like that are generally sold off within a year, and then the proceeds are held until the rightful owner can be found. So that timeline will vary, but there is no timeline in which we would need to turn it over. I mean, we will hold it until the rightful owner is found. That continues on to heirs. So, for example, if I had $1,000 and I passed away, my children would, if they were to find that unclaimed property, would be able to get that. So there's no limitation in that regard that is imposed by the state. So if the rightful owner can be found, they can make that claim.
So indefinitely. Thank you.
Any further questions at this time? Seeing none, Mr. Pearson, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Commissioner Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And now we'd like to proceed to the energy area, the department, the Office of Energy Security. Mr. Galan was hired 4 months ago, has come to the department with a significant amount of experience over many years and covered the region around Minnesota as well as Minnesota, and has covered the energy area from siting to an application all the way through construction. So he brings an immense amount of talent, and I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Galan.
Mr. Galan, welcome to the committee. Mr. Chair, members, thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Wilson. Because he didn't mention it, I wanted to mention about Commissioner Pearson, that he's actually, in addition to all of his other duties, which he outlined quite ably, he's assisting me with some of the energy issues that we have here at the legislature this session. So you may well see him in front of this body and wearing a different hat in another capacity as the session unfolds. The Minnesota Office of Energy Security was something created through, I believe it was an executive order of the governor approximately a year ago. It had been the Energy Division of the Department of Commerce, and before that had been part of the Department of Public Service some years ago. But our mission hasn't changed through all those name changes. It's been to promote adequate, reliable, and reasonably cost energy in an environmentally sound manner for the people of Minnesota. And we do that by administering a number of programs, including energy assistance, and this would be Minnesota's version of the National LIHEAP Low-Income Heating Assistance Program that you hear so much about this time of year in the news. Also, the state energy office, every state has an energy office, and our energy office for Minnesota is housed within the Office of Energy Security. The Conservation Improvement Program, all the state utilities are mandated to have a conservation program, both gas and electric utilities, are mandated, to save 1.5% of their energy sales each year through conservation efforts. We also, as Diane explained, the difference between the Public Utilities Commission and then the staff function. The staff function for energy, both on rate regulation and certificate of need regulation, the analytical work is housed within the Office of Energy Security. And we serve as the analytical staff for the Public Utilities Commission on those dockets. And finally, we are involved in infrastructure and supply planning. And I wear many hats, director of the office, deputy commissioner, as well as the acting reliability administrator for the state of Minnesota. So we also implement many pieces of legislation. I just wanted to highlight a few of them that we implement on behalf of the state. The Renewable Portfolio Standard, the RPS, our 25 and 25 is the shorthand, although Xcel Energy has a slightly different schedule that they have to follow in providing more renewable energy for their customers. We have the Next Gen Energy Act of 2007, and I'd point out that Commissioner Wilson, among his many duties, serves on the Next Gen Energy Board. And finally, the Green Solutions Act of 2008, dealing with greenhouse gas emissions, among other topics. Commissioner Wilson and I will give way here in a moment to the managers of the Office of Energy Security, whom I'll briefly introduce. We have John Harvenko. He is the director of the State Energy Assistance Program. Janet Streff, who's the manager of the State Energy Office, and Mariah White, who serves as manager of the Energy Regulation and Planning and Energy Facilities Permitting Group within the office. I know I don't expect you to be able to read this, but I wanted to give you a flavor of all of the state and local and national organizations that my staff is involved in. And a couple of highlights, I wanted to point out that both John and Janet serve as the vice chairs of their respective national organizations, the Association of the National Association of State Energy Offices, and also the Association of Energy Assistance Directors. So we have the two vice chairs of those organizations here in the room, and we'll be speaking to you shortly. And Mariah, her involvements are too numerous to name. She just gave me another one today that she's involved in. So I did want to point out one that she, from our office, along with the Public Utilities Commission, are the state's representatives to the Upper Midwest Transmission Development Initiative, something that started with the five-state region here fairly recently to promote coordination among the states in developing the transmission infrastructure that we're going to need to implement the renewable portfolio standard here in Minnesota. And they're just almost too numerous to name all the groups that we're involved in at the state and the federal level. Just really quick on our budget, and I know Tim touched on this in his presentation on Monday. We have what looks to be a fairly large budget over the biennium, but the bulk of the monies go toward grants through either LIHEAP or through our state energy office, and actually only a small amount is retained for use for paying our staff and the rent in our building, et cetera. And so we have the LIHEAP program is the bulk of it. State Energy Office, again, most of that $54 million is grants that we make, pass through our organization, make on to other entities. The Energy Planning and Advocacy Group, and also Energy Planning Systems, that's really where the reliability administrator is housed. And as I point out, 93% of the money that is in our two-year budget is passed through grant monies that come through our office, and only a small portion of it is retained to pay for our personnel and housing costs. With that, I'd like to turn it over to John Harvenko and the rest of my staff. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vaughn. Representative Smith, the other.
Thank you, Mr. Question. Chair. And I had a question for Mr. Guan, if he's not. I
almost got away, Mr. Guan.
I was noticing that in terms of the Office of Energy Security, we spend less than $10 million on energy planning and through your office. And I'm hoping you'll tell me that there's other places where we are investing in energy planning and systems planning. And is this just part of it, or does the PUC have any involvement in that, or where else is it happening, or is it just happening in your office?
Mr. Chair, Representative Knuth, I would point out the, and perhaps I can have Mariah touch on this in her presentation, the Public Utilities Commission has a very large role in planning through their granting of certificates. And one thing I didn't mention here, which Mariah certainly will, is the resource planning process, where each above a certain threshold, the state's utilities have to come in every 2 years with a resource plan. That plan has to be approved by the Public Utilities Commission. And again, as with the rate cases and certificates of need, Mariah's group serves as the staff for the Public Utilities Commission. But I would point out that the Public Utilities Commission itself has a staff, and folks like Bob Cupis and some of the other folks there are involved in planning efforts, and they work directly for the commissioners over at the PUC. And I would also like to point out, we have a group, we're a fairly small group, approximately 60 people work in the office, but we also work fairly closely with the Pollution Control Agency, the Ag Department, DEED, the Health Department, and any number of other agencies in coordinating the efforts. Energy touches so much of our lives and in so many different respects, whether it's utilities, electric and gas for our homes, fuel for our vehicles, and all the other ways in which we use energy, that the Office of Energy Security is involved in, is, I'd say, almost double-digit number of other agencies in coordinating the efforts of the administration.
Representative Atkins, do you have a question?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Guan, this real quick one, the $380 million comes in through the LIHEAP program. I assume that comes in at some point in time and then gets paid out somewhere down the road. There's a period of time when you have $380 million at a, obviously a lessening amount, but what instrument do you use to invest that money while you have it and it's not paid out? And what does that amount to? Does it then also go towards being paid out, or is it put to or towards other uses?
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, the director will be speaking here momentarily. I can explain to you the intricacies of the difference between the federal fiscal year and the state fiscal year and all that. Actually, I was going to see if Tim had a... do you have an answer to the question on the interest? John, do you have it? John will take care of that.
There is no interest? Mr. Chair, Mr. Guan, you might want to just come up. Would it be fair to say then that there is no time during which we have possession of the money? The claim comes in, and it's a... I'm just wondering why somebody's got to be getting interest on that money. It can't just be sitting there. I assume it's sitting in the federal account, and we're not able to avail ourselves of it.
Mr. Harbanko, could you please state your name for the record?
I'm John Harbanko. I'm the State Energy Assistance Director. Mr. Chair, Representative, similar to other DHS programs that are funded through the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, it's a drawdown process that those funds lie in an account at the federal level.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Harbanko. Mr. Glenn, actually, I had one question to ask. You said you did wear many hats. Can you explain, the reliability administrator has moved around between the PUC and the department, I think, numerous times. Is that function currently doing anything? Is there a role being performed there?
Mr. Chair, thanks for asking the question. And Ms. White will have more to say about the reliability administrator. It was formerly part or housed in the Public Utilities Commission, and a couple years ago it moved to the Department of Commerce under the Office of Energy Security. We are active. We do try to have quarterly meetings of the Reliability Administrator, bringing in stakeholders to discuss reliability issues. And in fact, we had a meeting this morning. MISO went and presented made a presentation to the Utilities Commission. We hope to have in the next couple of weeks a meeting of the stakeholder group, our quarterly meeting of the stakeholder group, and invite anybody who's interested in participating in that. These are held in a hearing room at the Public Utilities Commission.
The reason I ask is I believe there were a couple studies, or at least one study asked for, out of the Reliability Administrator from the Next Generation Energy Act of 2007. I don't believe if that ever was completed, so I was just following up on that.
Mr. Chair, I'll look into that.
Thank you. Mr. Harbankos, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As I stated, I'm John Harbank. I'm the State Director for the Energy Assistance Program. The Energy Assistance Program, which is also called the Energy LIHEAP at the federal level, the Low Income Home Energy Assistance Program, is funded through the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, considered a health and safety program by the Department of Health and Human Services. The intent of the program is to help households pay a portion of eligible households' energy costs, their actual energy costs. Another responsibility is to intervene in crisis energy crisis situations, conduct outreach activities to ensure that eligible households are served, and it also provides energy-related repairs, repairing or replacing furnaces. The funds, which are through the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, are provided to the Minnesota Department of Commerce, where the state agency designated by the governor to run the program. Those funds, in turn, are provided through grants to local agencies. Primarily, they're community action programs. There's 38 of them throughout the state, covering all geographic locations. Out of those 38 agencies, 27 of them are CAP community action programs. There are several counties that Department of Commerce contracts with, as well as Indian reservations and a nonprofit. In turn, those local agencies receive applications from households. They process those applications, and they pay energy companies on behalf of those households through an electronic web-based program that is administered by our department. The Energy Assistance Program for federal fiscal year 2009, which runs October 1st through September 30th of 2009, we've received $44.5 million in our regular allocation. In emergency contingency funds, so it was $19.4 million. Additional funds and leveraging grant for a total of $164 million. The regular allocation for federal fiscal year 09 represents about double of what our normal allocation is. Normally, we receive about $77 million. Nationally, the program traditionally was funded at about $2 billion. This most recent federal fiscal year is at $5.1 billion. So what are we going to do with $164 million? Our goal is to help more households. Traditionally serve about one-third of the eligible population in this state. Last year, we served 126,000 households. There's approximately 400,000 households income eligible for the program, so we will increase that number. We expect to serve upwards near 165,000 households. We will provide more crisis intervention services. That is, so far this year, up approximately 40% from last year. At this time, we'll serve more households receiving energy-related repairs and serve more households that are slightly over income through our Reach Out for Warmth program. We have also wanted to make sure we were serving the targeted population. The targeted population for this program are seniors, disabled, and families with children under 5 years old. Those are populations that are most at risk for health-related problems due to low heat in their home. A couple of stories I'd like to tell, as you keep in mind listening to this presentation, is having a retired senior on fixed income that is confronted with a very large bill, having to make that unfortunate decision between heating or eating or paying for their medicine. A disabled veteran whose face is a shutoff because her energy bill has accrued, potentially leaving her without heat and electricity in a life-threatening possible conditions, medical life support devices, or a minimum-age family with young children, and their furnace goes out in January, and those children become sick, suffer illnesses, and miss school. So keep in mind those particular groups. We wanted to make sure we were serving those groups. The Department of Commerce took the lead in pulling together some energy companies and other service providers and organizations outside our community of energy assistance programs, and we jointly developed a website. That I would like to go to, if I can. Bill? There we go. This website was created in conjunction with energy vendors, and in particular, CenterPoint Energy offered technical assistance as their web designers to develop. This was launched earlier this year. This website really consisted of a lot of information that all households, not just income-eligible households, for different programs, information that are critical to Minnesotans in winter. Those include making my home more energy efficient. It is a one-stop shop of information. We have a lot of information, or a lot of requests for information on financial assistance. And as I said, U.S. Department of Health and Human Services considers the LIHEAP program a health and safety program. We're very concerned about households keeping safe, using safe heat in their homes. This has been a very effective outreach tool, and we've had a lot of interest in this particular website. In addition to the website, we've also conducted other outreach activities. We've had more media requests and provided more information. We need to get the word out about our resources. We've also partnered with AARP. AARP has been a great partner. They are doing a mailing in February to income-eligible members of AARP to let inform seniors about this program, which is one of the targeted groups. The energy vendors regularly provide outreach activities to households, especially those who are getting behind on their bills. And we're in the process of working with the Social Security Administration, IRS, Revenue, and Food Shelf to reach those targeted populations. I'd like to just talk a little bit about some recent program improvements over the last couple of years. One of our most effective improvements has been a new computer system called EDI, the electronic web-based system that provides electronic fund transfers from the Department of Finance directly to energy companies on behalf of these households. That dramatically decreased the amount of time those households get benefits to their energy bill, therefore decreasing the amount of potential for shutoff for them. We also, instead of providing one lump sum payment to households, we broke those up into some scheduled payments throughout the heating season to lower their overall energy bill to make that more affordable to them. We've also increased the effort to have the households establish and keep bill payments. That's always a challenge with households that have a limited income, deciding where their limited resources should go, heating their home versus shelter and medicine and that type of thing. Part of our approach to ensure that those households are encouraged to pay, we've developed a coordinated responsibility model that we found very effective. The key components of that coordinated responsibility model is there's three major parties in this program. If any one of them failed to do their particular role, the program doesn't work well. So three parties include the energy vendors in the state, the households, and government and non-government programs. Each of them need to play their role. If any one of their role, if any one of them failed to do that, the program doesn't work as well. Unless there's questions for me, I'd like to turn over to my colleague, Janet Strupp, to talk about the energy office.
Representative Thielen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure whether Mr. Harvanko or Ms. Stress is better equipped to answer the question. If we have a couple hundred thousand households that are income eligible and not getting assistance, and the need is growing, I'm just wondering if you can describe the efforts to link the long-term structural opportunity with weatherization and limiting the growth or hopefully decreasing the number of income-eligible households, not by decreasing the income eligibility, but actually decreasing the number of folks needing help.
Mr. Urbanko or Ms. Stress?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe that Janet would be in the best position to answer that question. But the short answer is that my program serves the immediate need of households, the health and safety program. Janet's activities, programs, resources goes towards that more long-term desire to reduce those energy costs, long-term energy costs for those households.
Any other questions? Well, Mr. Harbankel, thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Streff, please welcome to the committee first, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Janet Streff. I manage the State Energy Office, and I wanted to spend a few minutes today telling you about it and its activities. The State Energy Office is a group that's made up of about 20 full-time employees, engineers, policy folks, who handle energy information for energy efficiency, renewable energy, handle the low-income weatherization program. We also take care of the conservation improvement program. We handle many grants, as you saw with the budget numbers. And we do a lot of work with renewable energy as well. We're funded in large part through money from the U.S. Department of Energy, although there is certainly state money for a match, and the state has always provided more than that match. I wanted to let you know that the state energy program, the U.S. Department of Energy program, is one conduit that the federal government is planning to use, it appears, to send some dollars down to the state to do energy efficiency and renewable energy projects.
Ms. Triff, if I could ask, do you have any idea about potential dollar numbers or things that are headed this way?
There is a wide range at this point. The House, I believe, was voting on it today. I don't know the results yet, but the House bill had $3.4 billion for the SEP program, while the Senate had $500 million on a national basis. So translated into Minnesota dollars would be $9 million if the Senate bill passed, or $60 million if the House bill passed. So we are awaiting to see what maybe middle figure there is before we really can understand the best way to use that money to create the most jobs and get the most energy efficiency done. As I mentioned, we handle the Utility Conservation Improvement Program, and that part of it is overseeing utility plans that come in, also looking at their status reports, approving any modifications to their plans. Again, 130 municipal utilities, 44 cooperatives, 11 investor-owned natural gas and electricity utilities, and since the 2007 Next Gen Act was passed, all of those utilities have provided their plans or will be providing their plans for the natural gas utilities in Excel for us to approve. So our small staff there of two that we just are hoping to make three have been working very hard. That group also reviews energy saving assumptions, and we have really increased the amount of measurement and verification that we're requiring them to do and report back to us. In the program, the utility spent $206 million in 2006 and 2007, and it resulted in 875 million kilowatt hours saved and 4 million MCF and natural gas saved, equaling about a little over a million tons of CO2 savings. This is for 2006 and 2007, which are the numbers before the Next Gen Act was passed. So those are fairly good numbers already, and our utilities are working hard to come up to the 1.5% We handle a lot of grant and rebate programs, and I wanted to point out on this slide the variety of money that has mostly come through state legislative programs. The Renewable Energy Production Incentive has been our longest running one, where we have helped start the wind industry in the state through the penny and a half incentive. Currently, that's about $10.9 million a year. Our solar rebate program is certainly fully subscribed at this point, but so far it's been $1.2 million that's been spent on it. Our E85 station infrastructure continues to grow. We had many renewable research grants, $2.2 million, and those are the next gen grants that the next gen board has overseen, and they've ranged a lot of renewable fuels, renewable transportation fuels, some plug-in hybrid money, so it really was a variety of projects. And then a dedicated anaerobic digester program. That was $1 million, and I believe we have 6 projects from that. As John said, our low-income weatherization program tries to address our needs on a long-term basis. So he served 126,000, and there were 400,000 that were eligible. All of those people are eligible then for weatherization once they pass the EAP eligibility test. This is the funding that we've had to date. I must say that the other is incorrect. The $0.1 million actually was the amount that we spent on our renewable energy equipment program last year, which has been extremely successful. We have put in highly efficient wood-burning furnaces in some parts, and our most popular program has been the installation of solar hot air panels, which has reduced the need for heating by 20-30%. So it's just been extremely successful. The other that is not mentioned there is the money that we get through a part of the propane tax. And that helps us to serve the households that do have propane as their main heating source. And last year, that was about $300,000 that we took in for that. The year before, $335,000. And through January for this year, it's been $182,000. The weatherization program, I want to also say, is run similarly to how the energy assistance program is, in that we do provide grants to multiple community action agencies, and then they do the actual work in their communities. So this is another program that is a star in the federal stimulus bill. In the House, they are asking for $6.2 billion nationally, and in the Senate, I think it was $2.9 billion. Again, translated into Minnesota numbers or households, I guess. Well, numbers, we, depending on the formula, because it could change, would be anywhere from $100 million to $250 million. And that translates into anywhere from 15,000 homes to 37,000 homes. So it will be a large increase in how this program is going to be run. We provide a lot of technical assistance, some training. We work with the Department of Labor and Industry on developing the energy code and making sure that it's a top-notch code. We have a state information center, energy information center, that's been going continuously since 1974. Where you can pick up the phone, it's probably the same number, and you will get an actual person who will answer your questions on energy efficiency and renewable energy. This fact is that shows the change that's happening, not as many phone calls, but we made up 55% of the total Department of Commerce web traffic. So people are accessing our energy information there. Another program that we've worked with on the energy efficiency side is the benchmarking tool, and we have we've benchmarked 80% of our public buildings to date. So it's a very good effort. All of our state buildings have been benchmarked, state agency buildings. I believe the University of Minnesota and Minsky are all in, so it's some counties and cities and school districts that are still not 100% complete. I did just find out today that that 80% is 243 million square feet are in the database. We're working on that database, seeing that it would be very beneficial and not very difficult to move that into a energy tracking tool. So it's not just benchmarking at once, but we're really going to be able to use it to help us know how our buildings are improving continuously. And then last year, a program was passed that will allow us to help the public building owners provide financing to get these energy efficiency improvements made once they know which of their buildings need it the most. So we're working on that and hope to get that launched in the very near future. And then the micro-energy loans help homeowners. We developed that by working with the Minnesota Housing and Finance Agency, and their Fix-It Fund of $20 million is tied to also allowing it to be used for micro-energy loans. Do a lot with renewable energy, as I said. Our solar rebate program is fully subscribed. This year we passed the milestone of having 1 megawatt of solar, of PV. So that was certainly a good goal. This last year we had 133 solar PV projects and then 38 residential solar hot water projects with the grant funds that you had provided. With the biofuels development, our E85 structure again surpasses any in the nation. We're at 350 E85 stations to date, and this year we actually sold 22 million gallons of E85. Wind energy advancement, no doubt about it, although I understand we're fourth in the nation, we are probably first in the nation as far as the amount of community wind that's been developed. As of December 31st, we had installed total almost 1,700 megawatts of wind. Seabed, the community-based energy development, was just under 120 megawatts. So that brings us to a total of 450 megawatts of community wind, community-owned wind that we've got. About one-third of the wind turbines that were installed in Minnesota in 2008 were community-owned. So we think it's been a good program. I mentioned a bit about the Next Gen Energy Grants with the anaerobic digesters, renewable methane. There was a program on that, multiple renewable transportation fuels, from cellulosic ethanol plant feasibility study to a study using woodland biomass resources to make sure that we'd have enough. Using the biomass to power operations for a facility as well. So it was a broad number of grants that were put in. And with plug-in hybrid vehicles, we've had a smaller, a smaller group of people interested, grant program where somebody can get money to convert a plug-in a hybrid vehicle to a plug-in hybrid vehicle. I wanted to tell you about one other grant, block grant that will be coming. It was passed in the federal legislation last year, and its first appropriation will be coming this year. The Energy Efficiency and Conservation Block Grant that will funnel a lot of money to cities and counties directly. But some of it will, 70% of the funds will go to larger cities and counties, and they will work directly with the U.S. Department of Energy to do good work. 2% of that is slated to go to tribal communities. 28% of the funds will come through our office, We will keep 12% of those for SEP, State Energy Program activities, and 16% will be funneled to the rest of the local units of government. So once, again, we know how much that money is, we will be meeting with the local units of government to really see what the best use is for that money that goes there. We're working with the League of Cities, Metro Cities already to see what they're planning. In the national level, that program was $3.5 billion in the House, and it was $4.2 billion in the Senate. So there should be a fair amount of money coming. What the 28% translates on the House side at $3.5 billion to approximately $18 million, so that would be about $12 million would be going to local units of government, the smaller ones, and $6 million would be staying in the State Energy Office. And I will let Mariah speak unless you have questions.
Well, I are there any questions for Ms. Strip? Seeing none, I think we're going to close the meeting. Ms. White, I apologize. I think we're going to have to ask you to come back at our next hearing, and we'd ask Deputy Commissioner Glahn and Commissioner Wilson to come back too. We love their presence so much that we keep bringing them back too. So, are there any announcements? Meeting is adjourned.